Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Back with us now, New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg, whose piece yesterday was titled The President and the Porn Star. The column puts into a broader historical and cultural context some of the latest reporting about Donald Trump's sexual activities and payments to keep them quiet, and the reactions from right and left, even touching on the new controversy around comedian Aziz Ansari. Michelle, thanks as always for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, hey, thank you so much for having me.
First, on some of what's new here factually, in and of itself, one thing you draw attention to is a line in the Michael Wolff book that hasn't gotten much attention. Steve Bannon saying that Trump lawyer Mark Kasowitz, quote, took care of maybe 100 women during the campaign. And you say if there's a significant scandal that might actually hurt Trump, it could come from the money trail around this. What are you imagining?
Well, I think that, so the column is about the fact that we have this rather remarkable circumstance that we know Trump has paid off this porn star $130,000 in the final weeks of the campaign to keep quiet. Just today, there's an old interview that she did, I guess, with a tabloid magazine called In Touch in 2011, in which she details this affair that she had with Trump when Melania had just given birth to their son, Barron. And to say,
this was originally reported the other day by the Wall Street Journal. It's not like it came from, you know, Huffington Post or something.
Right, by the Wall Street Journal, further details by the New York Times. And so, yeah, this is, and, you know, and there's not really been, the Trump camp has said that he didn't sleep with her. There's been no denial of this payoff. And so this is kind of a remarkable thing that would have one would imagine been a major scandal in any other administration, and has been here greeted with a sort of shrug. And in a way, it's almost a cosmic joke on everyone who was involved in the Clinton wars, because, you know, feminists and liberals and Democrats spent a lot of energy in the 90s arguing that the only standard is it legal and consensual? And so, you know, this meets that standard, right? So this is kind of the edge case. Like, I guess whether we, you know, there's no grounds under the criteria that we've set forward to criticize this. And conservatives who spent an enormous amount of energy in the 90s arguing that infidelity has national implications, that it shows a willingness to break vows and betray those close to you, and, you know, demonstrates that a person's character is somehow lacking, have now, in making their peace with Trump, sort of abandoned that argument and basically come to a consensus on the liberal view, right? It's legal, consensual, we have nothing to say about it. So basically everybody is more or less okay with the fact that the president has paid off this porn star $130,000 to be quiet. The significance, I think, is that because we have this line from the Michael Wolff book about 100 women and, you know, multiple payoffs, we all know that there are a lot of accusations against Trump that are for behavior that's not consensual. Another woman, another porn star who signed a non-disclosure agreement with the Trump camp, has alleged that he offered her $10,000 to have sex with him.
An even newer story than the Wall Street Journal one.
Right. And, you know, that was in Nevada, so the laws around there might be a little bit, I actually don't know if that's legal in Nevada. But then we get a little bit closer to misconduct. And I would imagine that just kind of playing the odds and seeing all the women that have accused Trump of harassment or assault, that some of the women that Bannon is referring to there were paid off to keep quiet about behavior that was not consensual.
And in terms of this broader cultural analysis that a lot of your column is, you're right that you don't think it's a coincidence that the right's tacit embrace of a laissez-faire approach to sexuality, at least male heterosexual sexuality, coincides with attempts on the left to erect new ethical guardrails around sex. So is the left erecting new ethical guardrails around sex really, do you think, or just trying to finally enforce some basic old ones, like a woman, not just a man, needs to say yes, and too much male power at work leads to a pattern of abusive sexual license in the workplace?
I think that feminists are trying to go beyond what I said earlier, which is that if it's legal and consensual, there's no reason for objection. Or at the very least, they're changing what consent means, right? From not saying no to not enthusiastically saying yes. And that's where I think this Aziz Ansari piece comes in. I mean, I don't think the piece should have been published. I think it was, you know, what he's accused of doing, even in this one-sided account, doesn't rise to the level of assault or harassment, and, you know, kind of bad private sexual behavior doesn't justify this level of invasion of privacy. But at the same time, I am kind of sympathetic to these younger feminists who are saying that we're not happy with sexual culture as it stands now. We're not happy with these standards that ignore that sort of ignore our interior lives and ignore our experiences and emotions, and we want to impose a new set of norms on relationships between men and women.
And on the Aziz Ansari incident and the reporting of it, you say among feminists, the reaction has broken down roughly generationally. Can you describe what you're seeing in terms of a generational divide and what it says about the larger moment that we're in?
So I should say it's not entirely roughly generationally, right? I have a colleague, Barry Weiss, who's younger than me, who has taken the same position as some of the older feminists, basically saying that this is a massive overreaction and that you kind of need to toughen up and deal with bad sex.
People may have seen her without knowing her name as well as they might know yours. People may have seen her column also in the New York Times yesterday.
Right, right. And so, but I think that in general, you know, people who kind of came of age in the 90s or before then came of age when there seemed to be a right-wing war on what conservatives considered deviance, you know, whether that meant the impeachment of Bill Clinton, whether that meant attacks on artists like Robert Mapplethorpe, you know. And so feminists of the era responded by sort of claiming like a right to be libidinous and a right to be raunchy, you know, as opposed against this like kind of prudish inquisitorial conservatism. And, you know, that was the grounds on which the culture war was fought. And to some extent, feminists, I mean, they, you know, were certainly still dealing with homophobia and attacks on reproductive rights, but we have won. The cultural left has won the central argument, I think, about what matters is that it's legal and consensual and everything else is private. And so in some sense, that kind of frees up energy to say, for some of these younger women, to say, well, this is not enough for us. And we're kind of, older women maybe prided themselves on their ability to be tough and as tough as men. And younger women, from where I sit, are saying, we don't want this. This isn't working for us.
Listeners, we can invite your phone calls for New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg. Did you read her piece yesterday or just listening to this? Do you want to get in on the conversation or ask her a question on the right and left sort of changing places from the 90s, or it getting kind of scrambled compared to what people watching the political culture wars as well as sexual culture wars of that decade might have expected, or something about the current Me Too moment or backlash, as either of which are exemplified by the Aziz Ansari story, if you've been following that. Or anything along those lines, writ large, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. What do you think generally about some of the backlash, and whether backlash is always the right word, from some non-right-wing sources, because articles expressing concern about too little distinction between types of transgressions or punishments or due process or a sex panic or a loss of women's agency as if it were Victorian times. All those phrases have been used in articles by the likes of Margaret Atwood, of all people, Masha Gessen, Andrew Sullivan, Daphne Merkin, and a petition by a group of French actresses, famously including Catherine Deneuve, that was also written up in the Times. How are you grappling with these concerns and given the source of some of them?
Well, I think that you've just mentioned a wide spectrum of concerns, right? I mean, Margaret Atwood was talking about a very specific case of a Canadian university as opposed to the broader Me Too movement. You know, Andrew Sullivan, I think it's not that surprising that he would take a position in opposition to what he sees as the excesses of the left. So here's where I am. On the one hand, I've been sort of worried about a backlash since the beginning. You know, I've been the early stories that sparked this whole movement were extremely scrupulously reported. And, you know, that made it incredibly hard to discount them. And it's part of what gave this movement such power. And as, you know, as reporting standards, as, you know, kind of other people have followed on and reporting standards have dropped, you know, as kind of more marginal publications have attempted to ride this wave, I think that you're seeing cases where people can be more skeptical. At the same time, one of my former Slate colleagues made a point today, which is that the very fact that people are drawing a distinction between, say, Harvey Weinstein and Aziz Ansari, you know, shows that, in fact, we're not just tarring everybody with the same broad brush. And we are able to kind of keep in mind that not all, you know, not all transgressions deserve the ultimate penalty.
Being fired in this case. Right.
Right. I mean, I would actually be surprised if this ended up ruining Aziz Ansari's career. I think there's other people who've been accused of, you know, there's other people who've been accused. People have sort of looked into it and they've, you know, either gotten a slap on the wrist or else people have decided that they didn't really rise to harassment and nothing has happened to them at all.
So to tie some of this back to Trump, you write that the Clinton-era culture wars seem blissfully simple compared to today, pitting a sexually libertarian left against an aggressively prudish right, and it's a cosmic irony that it's conservatives who have killed off the last remaining rules about presidential sexual ethics, ha. So we've been talking about just now progressive feminists grappling with complexity and contradiction here. How much do you see conservatives doing so in their own ideological house?
Well, I think the Never Trump conservatives obviously are. But in terms of, let's say, William Bennett, who wrote an entire book called The Death of Outrage about our failure to be outraged by Bill Clinton's moral failings.
Back in the 90s.
He actually wrote this piece where he sneered at the Never Trump conservatives for their moral, quote unquote, moral superiority. You know, so they have all discovered a sort of hard-headed moral realism. And I haven't seen, you know, on the religious right, I certainly haven't heard a peep from, you know, Jerry Falwell or Ralph Reed or any of the people that we used to, I don't want to say count on, but that used to be that used to inevitably come out and decry this sort of behavior.
Let's take a call from Jessica in the East Village. Hi, Jessica. You're on WNYC.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
So I just wanted to say that I am a millennial. I was born in 88. And I fully disagree with her feeling the need to come out with this story and as an accusation of sexual assault.
You mean you disagree with the publication of the Aziz Ansari story?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, growing up in New York, you know, I was, you know, a youth of the street. So I was, you know, making all kinds of mistakes. But, you know, I always put it on myself to have that experience. And, you know, how else do you know what's out there? to go through an experience and to learn what you do and what you don't want. And I think that if she has been on dates before, there's a certain implication to an invitation to someone's apartment. I think that more common sense needs to be practiced among younger millennials, perhaps.
I guess the defenders of the article might say that even in that context, if you're with a celebrity in his apartment and you keep giving him what was described as verbal and nonverbal cues of your discomfort with him proceeding, and then he insists on proceeding or pushing to proceed, then something has happened that's really not okay.
Sure. I mean, I do believe that if you're going to be a part of the movement, you should. I mean, I know that everyone has their own experiences in life and, you know, can't stand up for themselves in a certain way, but, you know, you should say no. That's the easiest word to say, is just no. And if you're not into it, you're not into how it starts off, you always have the right to leave. And if, you know, and then if not, then that's a whole other story, of course.
Jessica, thank you so much for your call. Do you want to get in on that at all?
I mean, to me, the problem is that I think that what we're conflating sort of ill treatment or, you know, just like being a cad with abuse. And maybe part of that is because we don't really give young women any other language in which to talk about their frustrations with the current sexual culture, right? I mean, either it's kind of legal and consensual and you have no grounds to object, or it's, you know, and so in order to kind of formulate an objection to being treated in a very, you know, cruel and callous way, you have to put it in the language of abuse, even if it doesn't quite fit.
And one is a private encounter, even if the man was being a cad or a pig or whatever word we want to use. The larger Me Too issue is about the workplace.
Right. It's about sexual abuse. I mean, it's about the workplace specifically, and then maybe sexual abuse more broadly. And so trying to shoehorn this into that rubric and use that rubric to justify this kind of extremely salacious, detailed piece, I think is not good for anyone. And, you know, I think that this magazine really exploited this young woman who, although thankfully still anonymous, is now being showered with, you know, all sorts of hate and opprobrium that I think is probably only going to make it even more difficult for her to process what happened to her.
Does it matter journalistically that, at least according to what I've read, the magazine approached her? She didn't decide there was a Me Too moment that she needed to come forward and share. Of course, she still had to make a decision to talk to a reporter. But does that matter?
I mean, to me, it makes it that much worse, right? In that they pursued this sort of non-story or the story that wasn't of public interest. And I mean, I don't know what the interaction was, but, you know, somebody in this process should have known better.
Deborah in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
What I wanted to say was that I find there's a very strong generational component in this. I'm in my mid-60s. I have always been a feminist. I grew up demonstrating in the 60s and I'm going to the Women's March. I've always been on the liberal side of issues, and I find myself kind of surprisingly on the other side. I think Me Too has gone too far. I'm enraged at what happened to Al Franken. I think that the goalposts have been moved. I think that your guest has just said, abuse has been conflated with, you know, someone being a jerk. And so somehow, and I think at WNYC, I was really upset about what happened to Leonard Lopate and Jonathan Schwartz, who are men in their late 70s, and I think the goalposts got moved on them. And we miss them.
And it's something that plays into another strain of this, I think. I think the example here, situation here, is an example of employers not feeling free, for whatever reason, to say publicly what their reasons were for firing or suspending some of these people. I don't think The New Yorker has ever said why they fired Ryan Lizza. I don't think PBS ever said why they cut ties with Tavis Smiley. And so everybody else is left in the position of either having to trust that something happened that was bad enough, a firing offense, or an accumulation of things that added up to a firing offense, and for the sake of the confidentiality probably of those who reported it, it's not for public consumption. Or the goalpost has to change on that too, Michelle, perhaps, so that the normal tension between transparency and privacy when it comes to public figures maybe needs to move.
I mean, I don't know, and I don't know enough about the laws around human about human resources to say that, you know, they can't kind of come out with a detailed forensic report of some of what these men did, you know, especially if the men themselves would consider that an invasion of privacy. I do think that, you know, some goalposts had to move, right? Like, if you look at what Charlie Rose did and consider the fact that, you know, it was an open secret. I had some intimation of it, and I'm not even, you know, kind of close to, even adjacent to that world. And yet, you know, and so, and then the goalpost moved on him, and people finally said, no, it's not okay to, you know, come out with your robe open during a business meeting or proposition the women on your staff, right? So, and, you know, maybe he was genuinely surprised because it had been okay for all those years, right? So there had to be some, I think some of the shifting of goalposts had to happen. But I agree with this caller's anxiety and sense of because we don't know what the new rules are exactly. There's a sense in which they can be applied very capriciously, and you know, and there is something disturbing about the idea that behavior that was considered okay when the person engaged in it is now going to retroactively be punished.
Doug in Midtown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Doug.
Yes, hi. I do want to separate kind of the corporate or commercial world from the private world. I think everything going on in the corporate commercial world is great, actually. In the big corporate world, you know, it's like any mistake there, whether it's in fraud or in any of these activities, is punished pretty severely, you know, kind of immediately. And so I think, minus, let's say, the big media industry, the regular corporate world's been this way on average for quite a while, and everyone kind of knows those goalposts. I think the goalpost in the, let's say, heterosexual community, especially with men now, younger men, 30s, 40s, I think is changing. And I think there's a gap right now where we need some, mature feminist writers, you know, a bunch of people with some big ideas to kind of almost explain in use case, you know, what's right, what's wrong, you know, what you should do. I mean, one of the problems is human chemistry is kind of important. And so to go through some kind of smart contract before you even meet somebody isn't exactly, you know, the most chemistry forming process. But I think this is happening, and so we have to kind of acknowledge that we need new ways to kind of navigate this, especially for, I'd say, on average, heterosexual men, who in general are, let's say, 75% to 95% of the predatory community. Is right, what is wrong, what you should do, when you shouldn't do it, et cetera, without trying to destroy all chemistry between, parties.
What are you thinking, Michelle?
I certainly, I'm not going to take it upon myself to rewrite the rules for people who were younger than me. I do think that young women really resent and are really furious about a situation in which men see sex as something to extract from them, as opposed to a kind of mutually pleasurable activity. And you know, I don't necessarily think that that's a dynamic. Well, I definitely don't think that that's a dynamic that can be changed legally. I do think there can be a new set of social norms in which at least you're considered, you know, a bad person if you don't pay attention to what the person you're trying to engage in sex with, you know, wants and enjoys and is ready for.
Thank you for your call, Doug. I really appreciate it. We're about out of time. To bring it back to your column yesterday, which was framed around Donald Trump and the porn star, which was the headline, and then went into these deeper cultural and historical analyses. You say, in a way, Trumpian sexual, well, I'm saying, in a way, Trumpian sexual license is what some conservatives always said about sexual liberation and even abortion rights, that they were going to enable more male power and abuse of power without consequences. How do you see that critique in the light of history?
Well, I think that that's what some conservatives have said, and that's also what radical feminists said, right? That
right.
The end point of kind of sexual liberation without a corresponding revolution in the power between men and women, yeah, the end point of that is just, you know, sanction for untrammeled male sexual license, not for everyone else. And that's sort of where we find ourselves.
It is so ironic, and we will leave it with this irony, that, you know, it's a kind of normalization. Everybody talks about resisting the normalization of what is frighteningly abnormal about Donald Trump, and sleeping with a porn star while your wife has a new baby and then paying the porn star to be quiet is just what everyone expects of this president, as you put it in your column.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I mean, the kind of bar for shock keeps getting higher and higher.
All right. Well, still unresolved is whether this will come back to haunt him more than it has so far. We thank New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg for this complicated and nuanced discussion.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.